Session number 16718. Major Wilfred White, Reel 5.
Mr. White, Reel 5. You were with the 7th Battalion of the Border Regiment in Lowestoft.
Yes, in Lowestoft, yes. It was a holding battalion, but they hadn't. They were manning defences. You know, part of the defensive organisation in case of an invasion. And they were also doing intensive training and producing regular drafts to supply the battle areas. And
had you, as I should have mentioned this before when we're talking about your training, did censorship or censoring other people's mail come into your training at any point?
There was no practice of that, but of course it was. We knew it had to be done, and we knew we'd get our whack of it.
If we can deal with censorship now, then get it out the way. Were you ever in a situation where you were censoring your men's mail? In the desert or wherever?
Well, the first experience of it was on the troop ship going out, where a committee almost ad hoc met in one of the messes on the ship, and the mail from the troops on the boat was brought in and shared out, and he just went through it quickly to make sure that none of the obvious things had to be in. And, that was when it started.
Did anyone censor officers' mail?
Oh yes, indeed. Cecilia could answer that for you, because I couldn't remember censoring. You see, I only did censoring when I was on the boat and when I was in hospital. You know, I was never conscious of censoring any of my troops' mail. I don't know that it worked that way. Don't know what happened there. I was never there long enough to find out. The officers' mail was, of course, censored as well as the other ranks. There was no trust, you know. And one incident, which is, there's a draft of RAF people, and there was two or three RAF on a big table censoring his lot of RAF mail. And this chap, you know, in a loud voice said, "Oh, here's somebody writing to my wife. Ha, ha, I've got him," you know. And he opened it and he was terribly quiet. And you can only guess what it was. A silly one, that. But there's that unpleasant one. And the other one I remember was, again, I don't know whether I should mention this story, but because it's an... It was a chap who had picked up a dose of transferable disease, and he wrote, "Dear Liz," or whatever. "I'm in the VD ward, but don't you think I've got a dose? You know, don't you think I've got a dose?" So I didn't know how to handle it, but I passed the buck over to the chaplain. I said, "That mustn't go to his wife. But what do you do with it? You would..." So that was just a not unfortunate. Mostly it was dates and where you are and what you can see that had to be crossed out.
What was the pay of a newly formed officer, newly trained officer?
I can't quite remember that precisely, but 10 bobs a day seems to stick in my mind, plus an extra 3 shillings overseas service. And I think if the overseas meant battle, nebbies it was 3 and 6 or 4 bob.
And did you have allowances to make out of that?
Oh, yes, your allocation had to be, you know, you had to virtually sign the book of how you wanted that money. Either you took it all, or you had to a wife or a girlfriend that you allocated to, and you just, you know, there was a whole organization to handle that once you told them what it was, but you had to tell them. And
were there any other expenses that would come from your pay?
Well, of course, the big one was when I was taken prisoner of war. What happened there was that you were allowed your same scale of pay, whatever your rank was. You got your full pay, but catch one, the ITIs in my case demanded that they took up a portion of that 50%, 60%, or 70%, whatever, for expenses that you're incurring, so that you're left with 3 or 4 bob a day. But being in a prisoner of war camp where the spread of officers was total, from first class jump jockeys to first class bank owners or bank managers, there was no problem. You see, they opened the book like they would in the bank, and every day they went by, they knew that somewhere or other there was 3 and 6 pence going to my credit, so they could total up from their books regularly how much I had to my credit of real money, and you could draw on that money up to that limit for any purpose you want. It might even be just playing cards, but you could gamble with real money, you see.
So this was sterling that was available to you in the prison camp?
Yes, but not in the form of sterling. You see, the Italians would... The money, the handling of the money was done by your men. And they had printed money, very much like the tickets you get for your cloakroom tickets, but it would have denominations of lira. So let's, for example, say the lira at that time was 10 to the pound, and I had £35 to my credit. I could draw up to 350 lira. The paper money, not real money. Not real money Italian or real money English. It was camp money. And
so can I get this correct? You were getting your pay...
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're getting your English pay.
Yes.
And the Italians were claiming so much of that,
mm-hmm,
from you for expenses, accommodation, whatever they called it.
That's right.
But so how did they...
Well, they had your name and rank and number, you see. And they obviously said, through the Red Cross or whatever the system was, this is a list, a full list of prisoners that we are holding. And no doubt they put it alongside each name. We want that much money from him every day. You know, Red Cross rules, you made them. So they'd end up and say, you give us whatever it is, £2,000 lira money for keeping your prisoner. Now, I didn't do anything. I had nothing to do with that.
So through the Red Cross or whoever, they were getting the money from the
English military. That's right. And they worked the Red Cross. The organization was quite fantastic. And of course, when you realize that the type of people you've got who can do these things, you know, you could get anything done. You could have a portrait of your wife done from a photograph in oils. You know, what size do you want? Well, you know, and because you had one or two artists, you know, and you want a new pair of shorts. Can you get me a pair of these? Okay, it'll cost you. And then you've got to see how much money you've got. The other thing was, which was very important in the... I know I'm jumping the story. I'm in the prisoner of war camp now. The other thing that was important was the Italians believed, keep them happy, they'll not try to escape. Well, it's partly truthful, isn't it? So you could get daily a glass of vermouth in the morning and a glass of Chianti in the evening. Yeah, I may have got it mixed up a bit now. But what they did, knowing how many prisoners and how much liquor there was, our wine stewards could draw against that knowledge. I mean, you can have, you know, X gallons of this and Y gallons of the other, by definition. So this, you want it all. They then issued to you a chit, our people who were controlling it, a chit for one, up to one vermouth a day, and another chit for one Chianti a day. So that if you said, now, I've managed Christmas all right, but my birthday's on January the 16th, I'll have a party. So you'd say to them, I don't want to draw my tickets. Hold them for January the 16th, when I will want, you know, 30, 40, 50, whatever. I just kept a book on it, so I didn't do it. And I went in, and on my birthday, I picked my team of lads who had been buying me drinks in the meanwhile, you know, and various things. Coming up, the drinks are on me tonight. So we could go in and, well, if you want to get sloshed, I suppose.
So coming back again to the pay situation, what was happening was that in this camp money, you were getting whatever money you were allowed, 3 and 6 months, in camp money from the Italians, and using that as your means of paying for things and so forth.
In the camp, because it had value in the camp, and that's where I made a mistake when we escaped, or were released. We all drew our pay, and I didn't have an enormous lot because I was a smoker and was always fiddling with my money to buy more cigarettes, you see. But I'd have £50 or £60 in my pocket. But in Italian money, no, correction, in Italian camp money, totally different. And I thought, well, we'll never, you know, this is a dead loss. Accepting that an Italian gave me some green tobacco leaf. And by rolling that up and putting it in the money, the camp money, it formed a cigarette. That was the thickness of the paper that it was. And I smoked all mine, and then had to watch Ian and another lad hand in that 200 or 300, it might have been 2 or 3 thousand, and being credited in English money. And I'd smoked all mine.
We'll come more on camp life, of course, when we get to that part of the story. So at Lowestoft, you were with the 7th Battalion, the Border Regiment, doing this job on the beach, and then you were put out onto, well, you went on embarkation leave.
Yeah, went
now,
home.
This time, of course, your parents would know you may be going somewhere dangerous.
Yes.
So how did they take you on that?
Well, you know, it was the middle of the night before I got back from the Lowestoft to the Newcastle. And having got over the, you know, you just left us last Friday. What are you doing back here on Wednesday? Have you been a naughty boy? You know, mother's concern. I said, no, I'm going overseas. You know, you can imagine the blow up. You're what? I'm going overseas. Where? Well, of course, no idea. Oh, and then the hysterics started. And mother's a hysterical sort of woman. I would great. And she's not as bad as what you see nowadays, but she let her feelings. There was no strong upper lip with mum. So I don't quite know how I got out of it. I said, oh, remember, although I wasn't married, you'll have to look after Cecilia when I'm away, you know, because it had been accepted. We were engaged, I believe. That's right, I borrowed the money from mother. Even till the day she died, she still said I didn't pay it back. £8, I remember, for a gold ring. I've no real memory of how we handled the situation, except mother was very upset. My father's ever apparently didn't, you know, he was quite the same, quite normal. And
Cecilia, how did she take it? Your girlfriend?
Yes. She took it very well. I mean, I obviously knew she was worried. I even got the first letter I got from Cecilia, you know, was at least three or four months after I got nothing for the first 5 or 6 months, and got a barrel of about 50 or 60, because she wrote every day. And
how important is mail to a soldier?
Oh, God, it's vital. It is vital. And the day you don't get anything, you know, you're a whipped dog, and you can shake it off. And of course, leaving home a few days in London, onto the boat, 8 weeks out on the boat, say 6 weeks, and then the Battle of Alamein. And I didn't have anything from either home or Cecilia. And it was while I was in hospital, I got, you know, the lot tipped it on my bed. And, indescribable. It must be the same way of winning the lottery, you know. Try and derate how you feel. It was rather pathetic and shame that she was worried, just saying, you know, I've been reading one of Daddy's Home Guard books. And she says, I hope you use the camouflage paint, because the face gives you away, you know. You know, poor herself. But she's dead right. But there was no problem there. There were no dramatics. And as far as Cecilia was concerned, I was very comfortable. The fact that we were, you know, in the situation, that it didn't present a problem to either of us, really. Although, obviously, we were both a bit chocking with the situation. And
was it obviously a very emotional time when you were had to pull away, moving away, at the end of your leave? Was that the worst time for you on that leave? the day you left?
No clear memory. Mother obviously made a bit of a scene, but it was in the content of our home. It was easily dealt with. There was no thing. I was far too excited to... it was when he got away, when I left Cecilia. I handled that all right, but as we... I can't remember how I got down. I suppose I went to London by train. That's right. I had a report at the Grand Metropole Hotel.
How long did you leave last? How long had they given you?
Less than a week. It was the abruptness of it all that either helped me or the fact that it wasn't lingering. This time next week I'll have left you, you know. We got home, say, on a Sunday, and I had to be in the Metropole Hotel by Wednesday. It was that sort of time span. And
you said this was something like July, August of 42.
That's right, yes. I've been a bit more precise, of course I worked it out in my notes, to sort of keep the timing of the Battle of Alamein right.
Did you know at this time which regiment, battalion you were going out on draft? You hadn't got that information?
No. It was just a draft. I was on a draft. I knew there wasn't any men going, you see, because I hadn't got any men. It was a draft of mixed span of mostly infantry officers, amongst whom was Teddy Worrell.
Was he starting out, had he been wounded or something, and he was coming back in?
No, not. No, he it was his first time out.
It was his first time out.
Yes. And he had the same pips up as me when he got on the boat. But the minute he was on his boat, he appeared with three pips. And I thought, now that can't be right. But I didn't understand that you could be a substantive lieutenant. But when you were here, but you had been a major, perhaps, in the job you were doing it over, in seniority. And you could take that seniority up. You could put your captain's pip up as soon as you were. And he, in fact, already knew, which we didn't know, that he was the senior officer in our draft. So when, instead of saying, well, you know, I know you, so you are my senior officer, I thought, now how the hell dare he do a thing like that? Whereas it was quite normal behavior. He took up his normal rank.
And you went, you said, to the Great Metropole Hotel where you had to report.
Yes.
Who were you reporting to there?
Them. They're just like instead of receiving by a receptionist, you received a man with, or men, with a big book. And I don't doubt that someone says infantrymen here and gunners there and so forth. That sort of selection. And I just fell in and gave my name, rank, and number. Get yourself into whatever room was. And until you get your next orders, the time's your own, but you've got to be in a 24-hour basis for moving. Don't care what you do, but you've got to be ready to move off with the rest of them in 24, or it might have been 12 hours, you know. It was that sort of instruction. And I had... an enjoyable night at a club called Hatchet in London, where servicemen were welcome. And I don't know if you were a musician or musically inclined, but a bloke playing the fiddle, you still hear him, he must be an old man, Stefan Grappelli. and Yango Reinhardt, his guitar player. They were the entertainment at this club. And amongst the people sitting and or dancing, but enjoying the music, was, do you remember Jack Albert and Cicely Courtnage? They were there. And of course, I was still goggle-eyed, because I hadn't been to... This was the first time in London at this stage. The first time I'd left home, really, at this stage. So in addition to the excitement of the trip, there was meeting these names, Yango Reinhardt, because I was a jazz buff then, you know, proper spiv. I still enjoy good jazz. And there it was.
What was your impressions of London?
Well, it just, you know, I thought it was the most marvellous thing. I couldn't get over the fact of, you know, you could go and have tea at the Ritz, and I could go across to the Royal Academy, and that Nelson's Column, you know, I'm still in that stage. The only opinion I could form was, you know, this is great. I didn't realize what else it meant, you know. And I met a young lad who I played cricket with, who lived near to me. He's in the RAF, but he wasn't on the draft. But I had great pleasure in taking him round. It was really a very happy time at that stage.
Were there any bombing raids going on?
No, none at all at the time we were there. But we got back one evening, I got back late, and the flag was up, or whatever, however they did it. But be ready to move off at 6 in the morning. And that was the message. There wasn't much to do. Just make sure you were shaved and had a clean shirt on, and whatever. And we were bussed down to King's Cross. Oh, it was that night we went. I got in. I must have got in about, had an early night, because I can remember there was just sufficient time to have a few hours kip, but I didn't have any, because we were going off on the night train from King's Cross to Glasgow.
And what equipment did you have to take with you, and what material, and how did you convey it?
Well, I had the normal army battle dress of the period. I don't doubt I had one or two long johns, but I didn't wear them, so I didn't take them. There had been issued to me, I think. A great coat, an army great coat. Which wasn't very smart. Two or three shirts and tie, collar and tie, and the usual mother saw that I had pyjamas and underpants, shaving gear, and that was about all. I never carried much personal possessions, you know.
We didn't have a weapon of any kind, a revolver, anything like that?
No, at that stage, no.
And did you? What did an officer carry their material in when they were going around moving?
Well, in my case, it was a kid bag. But I also had an old ammunition box that had come from somewhere. Because I can remember my father stenciling on it, Second Lieutenant W.S. White. My number was very much like our telephone number. I always mistake which is which. I often ring my regimental number up. There was that. Now, if you were to ask me how I transferred that around, I don't know the answer at the moment. Because all I took with me was it might have been a kit bag. It was a bag in which there were the necessities for the... But, you see, I had to draw... I can't understand how this happened. I had a certain amount of kit to take, like I can remember having a Desert chair and a bucket and a wash basin and a bed and this box. So it must have been sort of pushed on ahead of me somehow, you know, the way with all that kit in that I'd bought along the line somewhere. And then they're the sort of things that are held at your base depot when you go up the, into a war situation.
So I was going to ask you, actually, what kind of, becoming an officer, what kind of equipment or clothing or whatever that you had to buy personally?
Well, things like shirts.
You know, the other ranks would get them given.
Yes.
What kind did you have to buy?
Well, certainly shirts, a tie, of course, boots. Most of the equipment, most of the things you wore, other than your basic trousers and battle blouse, you had to buy yourself. That's why you got such a wide range of natty shirts, you know. And
did you get an allowance to enable you to do this?
I presume we. I presume we got some sort of allowance for kitting out. I think you did.